We did not get in Facebook. We got to get in the master account.
Yes. I have the access to some of them. Company too, so that'll work out.
Hopefully the meetings tomorrow will go well. Huh? Hopefully their meetings tomorrow will go well.
Yeah. It said it's been going pretty well so far.
I went to the first one.
Did you? Mm-hmm. Pretty good. Good.
They seem more attentive than I thought they would, but you just never know.
Yeah, stuff like that, I didn't know. I felt like it was a good idea, but just didn't know how it would be.
I don't know how financially it will turn out.
But here's the thing, though.
But if you're open enough that they actually understand what we do.
No, but here's my opinion. You know, you're not going to get those bigger checks from any of that, but you get a lot of little checks that could add up, something like that.
The thing is, do you get the church where they – my thing is, do we get – oops.
Everybody, we're going to get started in a few minutes. People are trickling in here and as well as on the line. So give us a few minutes and we'll get going. we could give everybody just a few more minutes. I know I could just tell just by looking that we don't have everybody here yet. So should we just give it another 2 or 3 minutes or so, and then we'll get started. Okay, everybody, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to, I think this is what, our fourth SR 260 meeting, third or fourth. Today we're going to be talking about sort of audit recommendations. I know that we asked everybody to kind of come with a few ideas to express the issues that they're having, and we'll get to all of those. But first, I'm going to go ahead around the room and take some roll. First of all, do we have Chrissy Johnson?
Hey, Jackson, I'm here.
Karen Stubbs is in the room. Mark Leiker?
Yep, I'm here.
Nick Alvarez? Kathy Kleber? Hey, who just joined us?
Bob Salas.
John Guyenfort.
Hey, Jackson, I'm here.
Colette Malasol.
Hey, this is Jessica Gandolfo standing in for her as proxy until she can make it.
Sounds good. Mike McNeil. Chris Mudd.
Here.
Donnie Oliver.
Here.
Ole Nash. Adrian Turner. Kimberly Richards. Lisa Rombach. Ernest Arhaya?
Yeah, I'll hear you.
Patty Williams?
Here.
Randy Key?
Here.
Ann Kahn? Greg Waddle? Anybody on the work group that I didn't call or that joined after I called their name?
Kathy Kleber.
Hey, Kathy.
Rob Salas.
Rob. Anybody else?
Gail Fowler with Magellan.
Gail.
And this is Cheryl Bauer Stevens with Healthy Blue.
And who else do we have that's not part of the work group but is here for either representing a health plan or because they saw the public notice or for some other reason? On
Dr. Mueller with ACLA.
And Jennifer Desitel with ACLA.
Anybody else? Not announce themselves on the phone? We've got some people in the room that haven't announced themselves yet.
Mark Kellyanne is here from Catholic Charities.
Catholic Charities is here. I'm sorry, Mark, what?
Kellyanne is in Chile.
Erin Ruther with LPA, Louisiana Psychological Association.
And Kelly Williams, same group.
Mike Johnson with the Institute for Neuropsychiatry out of Lake Charles.
Virginia Brandt, compliance office with LPA.
All right, so I guess we can go ahead and get started, and I will turn it over to our secretary, Karen Stubbs.
Yeah, guys, so as we had decided as a a group, sorry, a couple meetings ago about the topics of our agendas, one of the items that came up was audits. And so we decided to focus specifically, take one meeting and focus specifically on audits, because it seemed to be the source of a lot of conversation. Really, the voice is from a specific provider type, the mental health rehab providers, but it may affect all behavioral health providers. And so a little background, I think most of us attending have attended the last one or two meetings, but that this came out of a resolution to look at carving in behavioral health into the managed care entities that also manage primary care, physical health, med-surg, versus having another managed care company that deals with specifically specialized behavioral health. Through the initial conversations, it really came to light that the intent of the legislation wasn't necessarily a carve-in versus carve-out recommendation, but a look at the issues that have been caused because of a multitude of managed care companies and the burden that that has put on providers. And so one of the things that we're seeing with having multiple managed care entities are the volume of audits. We've heard it specifically with the mental health rehab group. So today we're here to discuss this. And in our planning for this, I did not want to strictly rehash the audit conversations that we had a multi-hour meeting in January, February of this year, but to put on the table potential solutions to the fact that providers will be audited, period. There are audits, there are compliance, there are requirements. There are audits around program integrity that, to be honest, the state's hands are tied with as far as flexibility, because Medicaid fraud, waste, and abuse is Medicaid fraud, waste, and abuse, and we cannot interfere in those investigations. But instead, to, with that understanding, come to the table about what some of the issues are that may be able to be addressed and potential solutions. And I think one of the keys out of this meeting is to talk about potential solutions or recommendations. And not all of them may be feasible, but I think it's a good idea to put them on the table, to talk it out, and then to say, you know, have an informed decision about whether that actually can be done. You know, we've heard recommendations before. We're like, legally, you can't even do that. But thank you for coming to the table with a suggestion versus a complaint that I have. I'm contracted with 5 MCOs and I'm getting 5 types of audits. So with that, my amount of time in the Office of Behavioral Health has allowed me to embrace the fact that at the beginning of a meeting, sometimes there just needs to be some kind of general processing, a little bit of unstructured time. And then those that know me know that I love to have a very structured meeting. So to find that balance, I think maybe we can kind of open it up with just a little bit of time around some general audit conversation. Sometimes people just need to talk, as has been the experience of everyone on this committee in the past. If you need to talk about a specific situation, I will only allow you to go so far. Then we'll pull it back in, try to tease out what might be a systemic issue there, or kind of the higher level issue. And we are not talking out specific provider audit situations at this time. We have representative of the MCOs, but unlike at the MHR stakeholder group, this group is not to deal with provider specific problems. So I'm putting that out there now in case I need to kind of redirect some of the conversation. I do know while this is not a mental health rehab group, we are mental health rehab provider heavy as per legislation. They have come to this meeting quite organized and put together a list of potential audit recommendations that I think actually might shape our conversation nicely. What I'm going to do, hold on just a second. Hey, Steve, come on in. What I'm going to do is for those of you on Zoom, Jackson, can I share my screen, even though you're host of Zoom?
Yeah.
Okay, so I can share these audit recommendations, and then I've also asked for people in the room for copies to be made to bring into the room. And so with that, there was a specific request from John that he kind of make a few opening comments about his list of 8 or not 9 audit recommendations that he have a few minutes to kind of do an introduction. And because he came to this meeting very prepared with a nice structured conversation, audit recommendations, I'm going to allow him that opportunity. But before John starts, let's just kind of open it up to the room. Is there any confusion about the topic or scope of this meeting or the work group that we should probably discuss now so we have a baseline of understanding? And guys on the phone, feel free to weigh in. We've got, I think, 28 participants. That's borderline manageable, but hey, Steve.
That's a lot of folks.
It is a lot of folks. A couple of them are actually in this room, though, so. All right, anyone? Conversations, questions before we begin? Again, kind of the point of this, the vision of this work group is to identify some of those barriers to the multiple MCOs and try to piece together how we can approach that. All right, John, we've got a quiet group on a Friday afternoon, so I'm going to hand off to you while I figure out how to share your 9, it's just 1 page, 9 audit recommendations. You can do it. I think I can do it. And guys in the room, we're waiting on hard copies, so it will come. John sent these yesterday. I was just able to catch up on emails this morning. So, all right. John, are you on?
Yeah, I'm on. I was just kind of waiting for the cue card there. Thanks, Karen. To follow up on some of Karen's conversations, and again, we really appreciate the opportunity to take some of the work group time to discuss this audit process, kind of set the stage a little bit. Yes, we certainly know that audits are necessary and that they're going to be provided. And I think a major issue for many of the providers is just the sheer number of audits that they're having to process throughout time that is basically contributing to the larger issue of the sustainability of the program. So let me comment on that a little bit. When we wrote SR 260, Karen, as you mentioned earlier, the sort of the driving force behind that was, well, maybe the solution to a lot of the issues that we're facing is just to carve behavioral health back out to a single NCO. It seems, or it seemed, that it would certainly make the process a whole lot more manageable. But I think there's a deeper question than just that, at least for the MHR providers. And I think what I'm hearing from some of the past SR 260 meetings, maybe even for the other types of behavioral health providers, hospitals, IOP programs, substance abuse, and so forth, and that is a need to really look at how to make behavioral health services more sustainable than they currently are. And I know in the MHR program, that's a major issue as providers are struggling to deal with cash flow. We've talked about many of those specifics in the past meetings. I won't go into that now. Other than to say that we look at preparing these audit recommendations from several points of view. One is, how could the audit process be streamlined or maybe modified a little bit so as to allow for quality auditing processes, but in a way that's not so financially challenging to agencies. That was one issue, and that's a big issue. The second is, the recommendations herein were based on our understanding that certainly the audits are designed to address issues or to uncover issues related to fraud, waste, and abuse. That clearly is a very important function. But that the audit tool, to some extent, was addressed not only to accomplish that, but to give the MCOs in the department a better look-see into the actual day-to-day operations of agencies, or one tool that would provide a look-see into agency operations day-to-day and just exactly how are these services, and I think probably more specifically in home and community-based services, actually being productive to kind of create some data matrices, if you will, to kind of take a look at that. So we put all of that together into formulating the 9 recommendations that we have here today. So I'll just kind of go ahead and launch into that right now.
And so, you know, John, our copies haven't come yet. So for the, unfortunately, the group of 8 or 9 of us in the room, you might read it out first while we're waiting.
Yeah. And Karen, I know that I think some of the callers on the phone, I thought you were asking in your earlier comment if they had any questions about the process. I know the process of SR 260, and I think may have misunderstood that that's what you were asking. And since you're waiting on the copies, we might want to take one more stab at just taking a few minutes for some of the callers to talk about those specific issues you were talking about earlier. Is that agreeable?
Sure, that's fine. We'll see what they are and if we can address them.
Okay. So we're opening the floor. I know in the meeting that we had with the 12 providers on Wednesday morning, we talked about doing this. I know a lot of you are on the phone. So here's your chance. Please speak now, because here shortly in a few minutes, we're going to move from those issues to specific recommendations. So please speak up now if there's something you want to say.
This is Rob.
Go ahead, Rob.
I think I think what's important, again, before we discuss the recommendations, is to kind of identify what some of the problems are. I think that you have identified that one of the problems certainly is by having 5 MCOs as compared to 1 MCO that as an entity that manages the care, is that means 5 times the amount of audits. So I think that that's certainly one issue. But I guess another issue is a more clear definition, as you say, of what the difference is. And I know we had to try to identify some of that before in the MHR work groups, but a clear definition of what the purpose of the audit is, what the difference is of an audit that's, it's a process audit that is basically identifying some areas of that providers need to improve in versus audits where, you know, clearly fraud or waste has been committed and or a violation, let's say, of a rule, you know, a Medicaid rule of how service should be provided or how, you know, credentialing should be done within the agency and, you know, recoupment of money. And I think that that's really some of the biggest issue. And I think some of the other providers maybe have some examples of that.
And so, Rob, just I'm taking notes to make sure that I've kind of summarized. And you're right, we had on the agenda originally defining audits, and I thought we had a PowerPoint from that original MHR meeting when Michael Boutte talked about the different types of audits. We did not have it, and I was unexpectedly out this week until this morning, and so was not able to create a new one. But it sounds like maybe one of the, I'm going to go out on a limb and put a few words in your mouth, but one of the recommendations that we can probably complete sooner than this report is due is almost like a one-pager of the types of audits and their purposes and how they may be initiated. Because I think we do use the word audits for things that are bigger than program integrity related audits. But then also, you didn't say this, but it sounded like you were talking about kind of the range of consequences. So if it's a quality monitoring review, not necessarily intended to be a recoupment for certain things, unless then, of course, that quality monitoring review presents some red flags that could lead into a program integrity type of audit around Medicaid fraud. So almost some published clarification on types of audits and intent and reasoning behind them.
Thank you. I think that that is kind of what I was trying to say is that I think it has that specific guidelines of what the consequences are for specific audits or infractions of, you know, rules or whatever. I think really, yes, that's very important because I feel like the consequences are being inconsistently applied. I think that's at this point. And I'm not talking about when there's a clear case of fraud, waste, or abuse or an SIU audit. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about non-SIU audits where, you know, the consequences are, it's not even just a recoupment of money. It's like, well, if you committed this on two sessions, then we're going to make an assumption that you have committed this infraction of a rule in a sense, or that you didn't provide the service in the way it was supposed to be provided on 25% of your sessions, and therefore we just now, you know, retroactively of just taking all this money back from you because we're just going to assume that that thing. Like that's just an example is what I'm trying to say, is those kinds of consequences for audits I think really need to be specified. So thank you.
Yes, Steve?
My question is, and I guess maybe this is kind of elementary, but how many audits are there? And especially who's doing the auditing? Because The only audit that I'm really familiar with are those that are done by the legislative auditor.
So as a provider, you are subject to a range of different audit type events. They could be the legislative auditors or the attorney general. Those are kind of the more public audits, but within the managed care companies, they each have program integrity type audit sections. There are also more clinical, I hate to use the word audit, we call them quality reviews, but more on the clinical side, that might be different than those fraud, waste, and abuse type audits that the managed care companies are doing. And then, Virginia, are there any other entities?
Office of Inspector General also conducts audits because they're nationwide and they oversee Medicaid and Medicare. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see as much of them just because of the spread of their resources.
So that's HHS-OIG.
Yes, HHS-OIG.
And that's State Inspector General.
The State Office of Inspector General does have the authority. If there are state funds expended, they have the authority to do those types of audits. They generally don't step into that arena because they have a very, very small staff.
Okay. Thank you.
Additionally, there is outside of the program integrity SIU audits that the MCOs do, a number of them do more classical, traditional type, just random sampling audits. And that's just an oversight function that, you know, would be recommended by their external auditors most likely. Mm-hmm. The program integrity SIU audits generally are focused on a specific issue or a specific allegation.
And so I'm curious if we've got non-specialized behavioral health providers on the line or in the room, if you also kind of encounter this, because you have been subjected to 5 MCOs. Does anyone want to share their experiences? I know the past 2 meetings when I've called on non-behavioral health representatives, no one has really spoken up, so thank you. Thank you. All right, so John, I think we're good. Rob, I appreciate those comments. I think they really made a lot of sense.
Okay, so I assume at this point we're ready to get back to the specific recommendations in this document.
And yes, and everybody has a copy, John, so we're on the same page as you.
So I'm just going to quickly go through these and kind of read each one, give a little bit of perspective as to how we came up with each one and why, so we can then move quickly to opening the floor to discussion about all of this. So here we go. As has already been mentioned in the conversation so far, one of the things that we perceive would be helpful is standardization of the audit process and the audit tool. And that has to do with the frequency and the volume of audits, but I think it also has to do with another very important consideration here. And that is, there's been a lot of discussion about the audit tool. We talked about that a little bit in the past meetings about how it seems to be really process-driven. We've talked about maybe shifting to more of an outcome-driven system. We appreciate the sort of the pushback on that in terms of not wanting to give up the process measures because that provides information about what's going on within agencies. And I think it leads to health and welfare issues and those sorts of things. So that said, maybe one way to approach this would be to take the current audit tool that we understand has been pretty much developed after a lot of work on the part of the department.
And John, I'm sorry for interrupting, but by audit tool, you mean the quality monitoring tool that we have online that kind of follows the service definition manual?
You know, Karen, that's a really good question, because I think at this point we hear that an audit tool is being used, but we're not really sure what it is, other than that when we undergo the audit and we look at the audit results, it seems that those results are based on a large number of process standards. So one question here, if in fact that's the case, is how does that tool or those tools that are loaded with process standards point to any kind of outcome measures that reflect how those services are actually impacting the lives of consumers? Does that make sense?
It does. It might be beyond the scope of audits and the kind of the volume of audits, which is kind of the heart of the complaint, because that's a very clinical document, or not clinical, but it goes along the lines of the service definition manual. It's kind of just a checklist, almost, if you will, of the service definition manual. And so you're right, we've admitted that it's not an outcome-based tool. It's a quality compliance tool that we would love to move more in the direction of the outcome measures. But if I understand, maybe your point is, how does that tool play into the audits that the other audits the MCOs may do?
So yeah, and I'm glad that we got to really to this point in the discussion, because the point that we have arrived at in our discussions and our discussions amongst our colleagues, and I think really with the MCOs, is how can, and in this respect, we may really be talking more about the audit tool that's being used for these SIU audits. I'm not sure. Our understanding at this point is that there is some kind of audit tool that has been prepared by the department, given to the MCOs, that seem to be used not only for what we call the clinical audits, but what are really the quality review audits, but these SIU audits as well. Maybe that's the same tool, maybe it's not. It may be that what we're really looking at, if there are multiple tools being used, that there's an overlap of those tools. So how do we get control over that so that the auditing process is sustainable to agencies, that it's not chewing up a tremendous amount of their financial resources, but also, and I think here is maybe the next point that's most important, or maybe most important for our discussion today, how can those audit tools be used as a resource for providers for improving the quality of care within their agencies? And I think that leads to the second item on the list, and that is education of providers on a standardized audit tool, and how those standards apply to certain categories of service provision that include, but may not necessarily be limited to, the following, like assessments, treatment plans, documentation, health and safety. We know that those are things that are being looked at by the audit tool or the audit tools. And I think it would be really helpful for providers to be able to look at that tool, and with consensus from the department and the MCOs, categorize those standards into these different categories so that we can use them as a quality monitoring tool within our own agencies, and also use those standards as categorized as a training tool internally for our staff. And to us, that seems to be that constitutes a really important recommendation. And then number three, real clear written delineation of how the multitude of process standards that comprise the, and I'm saying here LDH audit tools, but we may be talking about audit tools plural, being used by the five MCOs relate to any outcome measures. And the bullet item under that I've pretty much already covered thus far. So, one thing we're looking at is a recommendation. Don't know how realistic it is. That's up for discussion. Is it possible to create standardized audit tools? an audit, a standardized audit tool, and it may be that we're looking at multiple audit tools that are standardized. For example, we mentioned two categories here, quality reviews. We mentioned SIU audits, compliance audits. I'm not sure how all of those terms flow together. But if we could look at that, and let's just say for the sake of simplicity and the sake of discussion here, if what we're looking at is quality reviews and SIU type reviews, is there a standardized audit tool that could be used for each of those types of reviews? That would be used by the parties that are conducting these different types of audits. So that's one question on the table. And then the second question is, how could those tools be used as a really valuable training resource so that providers clearly understand exactly what they're being evaluated on, at least in terms of those process measures, and then internally to develop policies and procedures and staff training that's designed to deliver services that would be of high fidelity to those standards. So those are two important considerations that we look at. And then we talked about in number four, we've already talked about how can we make this introduce some outcome measures, making a connection between the audit outcomes using these tools that seem to be really process driven, and what do those outcomes, those audit findings tell us about specific outcomes that are held to be important and valuable by the larger city, by the larger system of care. So as we look at that, one of the things that that have been talked about before and that we think is important is where to go to get those outcome measures. And of course, we want that to be as evidence-driven as possible. Now, FAMHSA has created, done a really good job of creating different EDIS measures that point to specific outcomes to be accomplished in primary health care to some extent, substance abuse and behavioral health care. And maybe we could go to those standards to identify as a collaborative group of the department, the MCOs and the providers, as to what those outcome measures should be and how agencies shall be evaluated, monitored, audited, whatever, with respect to producing those outcome measures. Because I think that's where we transition from the processes that exist now as process-driven audit to that then in turn points to specific outcome measures that not only tells the department how providers are doing and affecting the lives of consumers, but then also as a training tool, providing feedback to providers as to what they need to do to amp up the compliance to these outcome measures so that we make the complete transition from auditing and process measures to outcome measures and how all of that actually impacts what we think is the most important part of this and how is all of this impacting consumers and resulting in an improvement in their life and I think also resulting in enhancement of the network as a whole, the service network as a whole. I think number five relates back to something that Rob brought up, and we keep coming back to this issue, and it's a question of a clear distinction between clinical slash quality review type audits and SIU audits. And that leads to a couple of sub-questions that we think is important. And this first one, to some extent, deals with just the sheer volume of audits that we're looking at. So the question is, under what conditions will SIU audits be conducted? For example, adverse findings from clinical or quality review audits that point to fraud, waste, abuse, or whatever, consumer complaints. Because right now, our clear perception is that the vast majority of audits that we are receiving and the multitude of audits that we're receiving appear to be SIU audits that are resulting in punitive consequences to agencies that primarily relate to recoupment of large sums of money. We're not really seeing a whole lot by way of comparison to those kinds of audits, the more clinical or quality review audits. So when we think back to the old days, when this program was managed by the Office of Behavioral Health, before we transitioned into managed care and then into the five companies that we have now, the SIU audits SIRS audits typically occurred when there was a significant consumer complaint, a significant pattern of consumer complaints about an agency, or there were findings in the clinical or quality review audits that pointed to a need to investigate and determine whether fraud, waste, and abuse was being created. That was a much more manageable system, and I think our question at this point is, could we better define what these two types of audits are and then look back to that time and see if maybe the system that we had in place now would be a more reasonable system to implement at the present time?
And so, John, will you repeat? You said back before managed care, there were two things that drove SIU audits, and one was complaints or trends in complaints, and what was the other?
The other was adverse findings within a clinical audit, or what we're now referring to as the quality review audit, that pointed either clearly to or a strong suspicion of fraud, waste,
I can speak a little bit to this. I was the SIRS manager for a little over a year, so I know that in large part the SIRS reviews were complaint driven, but they were complaints from a multitude of different sources, pretty much anywhere. They have a hotline, anybody can call in with a complaint, and that complaint has to be addressed in some capacity. But in addition to that, they also did data analytics, and they identified outliers through the data analytics, and there would be a number of cases that would result from that.
Yeah. And so, John, just so I'm following, and I assumed we were going to let you go through this and then kind of go back and have a conversation about each one, but were you saying that in the old days when they were complaint-driven or adverse clinical finding-driven, that that's what you want to go back to, or that that's also what's happening now?
Well, I think it's what we want to go back to by way of creating a better and clearly understood distinction between quality review audit and SIU type audits.
Okay, and I get.
Because
I think
now everything seems to be SIU.
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate recommendation is that distinguish between the two. I think the only thing I would kind of that makes me pause is that. Right now, a lot of the investigations are complaint-driven and referral-driven, and so in that way, it's very similar to how it used to be. I mean, we've heard testimony from the AG's office and other places that the volume of provider complaints on other providers, and, actually, I think that's probably the majority of it, is huge, and that does trigger a lot of their audits, but if the point is just a clearer distinction between the two different types, I think that's completely reasonable.
So, Karen, I think maybe one of the things we're looking at based upon what you just said is, again, looking at those analytics, and why is it that there seems to be such a dramatic increase in the number of audits if that's a function of a really statistically significant increase in the number of complaints? Why is that occurring? And I think that's an important question to answer from the point of view of how do we not only address the audit issue, but from the point of view of network development.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so, and I know you're writing down, so I don't want to be too much of a challenge there. If we're moving on to number six, and we've talked about this before, written definitions that clearly define the terms fraud, waste, and abuse. And I think what we're really trying to get to there is understanding this basket that includes fraud, waste, and abuse, and separating that from the basket of audit findings that are not fraud, waste, and abuse, and how do we make a distinction here, which kind of leads to our next item, as to what should result in more of a corrective action plan versus punitive action towards an agency that could include recruitment and potentially even criminal charges. So that kind of leads us into number seven. With everything that's been said before, we know, and we've discussed the whole issue of credentialing by way of comparison here in the past and what we've evolved to, and we talked about that a little bit on another call today, creating a single independent unit that would collect and provide credentialing information from individuals, agencies, and then supply that to the department and to the MCOs. So it raises the question of all factors considered, would it be a more streamlined approach to the audit process if we created a single entity, a single independent entity that would conduct these various types of audits? And we seem to be looking at two major categories. There may be others, quality reviews and SIU type audits, and then providing the results of those audits to the department and to the MCOs as a way, as perhaps a more efficient way of managing the network overall and ensuring quality care. I know that's probably going to be a controversial item. I'm going to leave it there and move on to number eight. So getting back to the whole idea of really looking at this also in terms of network development and a training tool for providers, it seems to us a good recommendation to look at providing top-down training on the audit tools or audit tools that are being used in the quality review audits and the SIU type audits. And for the department to, for example, provide training to the MCOs or whoever it is that's doing these audits on exactly what is expected from each of the audit standards in the audit tool or the audit tools. And then for the providers in turn to receive the same training concerning the same expectations. And I think that would take us a long way to providers not only understanding what the audits are looking at, what the purpose of the audits are, and I think kind of help transition us into specific outcomes that we expect to be provided, that payers and policymakers expect to be provided by provider agencies, but also as a way in general of just improving the overall quality of the network. And then towards that training, and to kind of make this as scientific as possible, so to speak, during the training with the MCOs, I understand this is going on quite a bit, that they do inter-rater reliability testing between their raters that are conducting these audits to make sure there's a high degree of reliability and standardization of rater outcomes. But I think then to carry that a step farther, one of the things that really seemed intriguing to me personally was the opportunity to get training on the audit tools, what's expected, and then to be able to sit in a room and use those audit tools, perhaps on a redacted case with the raters from the MCOs or whoever's doing the audit in the room, and see how my ratings compare to theirs to create a high degree of inter-rater reliability between the auditing raters and the people who are going to be using those audit tools as a training tool and program development tool within their own agencies. And then finally, and I know this is probably going to be controversial as well, given everything that we said above, perhaps suspend recruitment until the above referenced issues are addressed as policy, unless in the audit, as we've already discussed, irrefutable evidence of fraud, waste, abuse is indicated by the audit findings. So I think that brings us to the point of discussion.
Yes, thank you, John, and thank you for presenting these kind of so clearly. I think some of them are easy and make sense. Some of them, I think, probably literally, legally, we cannot do, and some probably fall in the middle somewhere. And so I don't know the feeling of the group, if we want to kind of start back at the top and talk. I mean, there's a few that stand out that I think warrant more conversation than others, but I'm looking to the members of the group, not the kind of general public that's attending, about whether we should jump in. And so I guess we'll start at the top and see where the conversation takes us. Standardization of the audit process across all five MCOs. And I think, you know, when we met at the beginning of the year and had a conversation about some standard protocol, like I remember it was as basic as introduce yourself. Tell them what MCO you're from and where you're from, you know, things like that weren't being done initially, that were kind of a really easy, let's make this kind of part of the process was easy. So, but I think now when you talk about standardization of the audit process across five MCOs, I'm guessing that number one, the key word here is the process. Can you talk to us about what you mean? I mean, because you talk later about a standardized audit tool, which I'm guessing is separate than an audit process. Do you mean how they approach you, the kind of documents they're asking for, you know, basic, I guess, forms would be more along the tool, but what are your thoughts behind the standard process?
So maybe one way to jumpstart this part of the conversation is that probably to a large extent, the audit tool itself defines the process.
Okay. And so let me also be clear, the department does not have an audit tool. An audit tool does not exist from the Department of Health. I know I've said this before. I assume what you're talking about is the quality monitoring tool that I believe is online and that the MCOs are required to use, and it's what I keep saying basically follows the service definition manual. It's a checklist, if you will, of things that it's just almost a different format of the manual to guide kind of compliance with that manual. And so, you know, maybe that's where we need to start. I think some of the MCOs have taken that quality tool and they use it exactly. I think some have taken it and in their process of using it have added to it to fulfill other requirements. And so I do kind of want to get that on the table. Virginia, to your knowledge, is there any other audit tool that the department mandates?
No, there isn't. To my knowledge, no audit tool that the department mandates. And outside of very, very general direction on audits, it actually almost flies in the face of audit standards to have a really defined audit tool, because if you think about what has happened, you know, in the last 20 years with WorldCom and Enron and things of that nature, auditors have been called on the carpet, so to speak, for doing the same thing every time, so that the auditee knows exactly what to expect when the auditor comes in. So there's an expectation that what you do from one audit to the next will vary. And it is going to have to, in the SIU audits in particular, it's going to have to vary depending on what the specific allegations in that case are.
And so what I can say, John, is that the quality monitoring tool that we have online, I know both in number two and and then number eight, I will commit to volunteering my team to take that quality monitoring tool, and maybe we can take one of the, because this tool, it applies to all behavioral health providers, but there are specific sections, because the service definition manual has different sections. In one of the MHR work groups, We can walk through that tool happily with the work group for the section that applies to mental health rehab providers. And of course, MCOs are in that meeting as well. I think that's probably a really good suggestion. I know, I think way back in the day, there were maybe a couple of conference calls or webinars when we were developing that. And so we did a little bit of training with the MCOs, but I will commit to doing that, which may help. I'll repeat that if mental health rehab providers are surprised by what's in it, then they haven't read the service definition manual. But I also think it cannot hurt to walk through it, and I'll be happy to do that with the MCOs so they can ask questions as well.
Go ahead.
I think that's that's really great, Karen. That's a great idea. I think that standardization of the process, I think we are looking at standardized audit tool to be used by all the MCOs. I think the issue that was just brought up about, you know, auditors are not supposed to be looking at the same thing every time, that's a good point, except I think that they decide what to focus on in an audit, in that specific audit, in from the standardized tool, in other words, because they may not be going through every single item on a tool or in an audit and looking for every single thing. They may be just focused on certain things. I think another issue relates to a standardization of kind of what's reasonable, meaning how many audits, process audits, in what amount of time, and, you know, what percentage, for example, of your cases should be audited. And so I think that's that kind of standardization. In other words, like, we need to look at, you know, quantity of audits and how many charts are being audited. And I think one of that recommendation down here that we get to eventually, which is, you know, can there be a single entity for all of the MCOs, that conducts audits for all of the MCOs, does a cross section of charts, because that would really make these audits much more standardized.
So that's really interesting, Rob. I think that's Rob. I think I'm recognizing your voice.
Yeah.
Let's jump to that. I would like to specifically address 6 and 7 and have some conversation around those, since we have Virginia in the room. And clearly I'm not the audit expert. Virginia is for the department, and I've made no secret that she has been very helpful for me and comes with a vast amount of experience. So this concept of a single kind of contracted entity that would do audits on behalf of the MCOs, I'm curious if any of the MCOs on the phone have any thoughts or kind of initial gut reactions, and it's kind of the first time that I think most people would be hearing this concept, other than the 12 members of this group who pre-met. And John had run it past me in a phone call kind of very briefly in a one-sentence way, and I had never really thought about it or had a conversation about it. So let's talk MCOs. Do you have any initial gut reactions?
Yeah, this is Dr. Muller from ACLA. And actually, before the 358 quality monitoring of the behavioral health providers was started on October the 1st, 2018, we had a delay because the 5 MCOs were discussing the hiring or using of a single entity to do those audits. And we talked to one in particular, the 5 MCOs, and got information regarding what they could do, how they would do it, and of course the price. And the 5 MCOs independently decided whether or not to use this organization. That the initial thought was we would all 5 use the organization, As the discussions continued, it became clear that some of the MCOs were not interested in hiring and contracting with this organization. There was a discussion. So we also, the five MCOs, have met and agreed to use one single entity to do the fidelity monitoring for our ACT team. So it's certainly not an unheard of concept. It's something that we certainly could consider going back to consider. The biggest problem, and I can up front, is the expense. That the price that we were given per MCO for this single auditing entity was very expensive.
So that most
of the MCOs decided not to go that route.
And so I remember that conversation. I was not part of the details of that conversation, but my guess is one of the distinctions too is that with ACT, we've got 30-something providers across the state, and with MHR, we've got 330, give or take, roughly, providers. And
well,
so,
it's not just the MHRs too. It's all behavioral health providers. So
which is a good point.
That's a much greater quantity.
And the quality monitoring tool, and you reminded me, we call it internally the 358. It's for all providers, not just MHR. And I keep repeating that this group is bigger than MHR, but that is kind of the voice that's at the table.
It's for all behavioral health providers.
Yeah. And I want to be clear. So it sounds like, I'm wondering, I don't know if Kathy Cleaver is on the line. But Kathy, maybe that's something you can take back and try that conversation one more time, because it's been over a year since the last time we had that conversation. But I also want to make sure that these are the clinical reviews. So the concept of taking away an MCO's, it's almost kind of a fundamental right, but also a fundamental responsibility to conduct their fraud, waste, and abuse audits, as I understand it, cannot be displaced. And Virginia, I'm going to look to you to see what your thoughts are, not on the clinical tools that Dr. Muller and we have talked about, but from the program integrity standpoint.
I'm not going to say that they cannot contract with an outside entity to do those audits, because I do believe some of the MCOs do contract with outside entities for some of those audits, particularly if you get into a specialized area where they may not have the resources to look at it themselves. But they do have to maintain oversight of that.
And Karen, this is Kathy. Yes, I'm on the line, and I can certainly do that. And again, as Betty said, the big issue then was the expense. But I will also reiterate, this is just one part of this auditing process, and I'm not sure it's the most biggest issue in terms of the auditing process, but I do think it would help, and I certainly can bring it back up. I was extremely excited last time about the possibility of them using one entity, but the cost was pretty exorbitant. So, and maybe there's some other entities out there now that are doing it differently and that we can explore again. I will, though, say that the other audits that are done by the companies, I mean, they're not going to be able to make all of those uniform, because every entity has different requirements that they may have nationally that they have to make sure occur. And I just don't see that as being able to be made uniform as people would like, as uniform as people would like it. There may be some standardization done in it, but there are individual things that various companies look for in terms of the auditing that are requirements of their, you know, their national entities.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Kathy. I appreciate you taking back, and it's something we can, when the MCOs revisit, they can, instead of doing all providers, maybe try to narrow it down and start with just MHR providers and then have it grow or not grow, almost pilot-like. So anyways, we'll take that down as a task for you. So let me see. So John, just trying to kind of check some things off with number 7. It seems like we've had some good discussion and a takeaway. And thank you, Dr. Muller, for refreshing our memories about this first part of 7. And then the second part, I kind of divided it into two parts, was training of providers. And so, you know, I don't, with regards to the 358 report, you know, again, I will commit for MHR and for any providers who want, we can review that tool with providers again as well. I'm thinking after the first of the year. And so we can proceed in that way too. And so let me see, does anybody have any other comments about the concepts in number seven? The only other
comment I have about number seven, and this gets to the cost issue, I would wonder, as a way of comparison, what is the aggregate cost of providing these audits by the five MCOs versus the cost of breaking that out to the one entity that we talked to so far? And then the second thing related to that is I wonder how that cost might be reduced if the process of contracting with a single entity was by way of a competitive bid process, where the requirements of the auditing that would be done by that single entity are pretty much defined by us and made a part of the RFP process for potential companies that want to be the contractor to bid on. So I just wonder if maybe a more competitive process would help to reduce the cost to where it would be reasonable.
Yeah, I don't know that the MCOs are required to follow an RFP process. I think what they could do is...
No. I don't mean the MCOs. I mean the people that would be competing to be the independent auditing entity would have to compete for.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about. So the auditing entity would have to respond, if I followed you, to an RFP that would need to be let by the MCOs. And I'm thinking it would be more of like a solicitation of interest that the MCOs would release and then field responses and look at budgets in that way. In a similar capacity, not actually being an RFP, because the RFP process is what the state is required to go through, and the state would not be holding the contract. The five MCOs would kind of jointly be, and so an RFP-like process. So basically, I think your point is making this search a little more public to see if the MCOs get a little more interest and therefore have some competition in the price.
Exactly. Well said. Mm-hmm.
Technically, Steve, you're not part of the work group.
I'm sorry.
But I'm going to let you ask your question.
Oh, thank you. Well, one point that you had made earlier, if the MCO has additional requirements in their auditing, how are you going to deal with that if you have one audit group?
So that is the reality, that this conversation is about this quality monitoring kind of tool. It would not particularly be addressing the program integrity. And so some of the MCOs may still, on top of this, depending on what they're able to agree to and include in it, have to go out and do small chunks of an additional audit, depending on internally how they function. So I don't know that it would clean it up completely. And I don't know if what we're talking about is, you know, would be the clinical perspective and the program integrity perspective, but I think that's kind of for the MCOs to go back and talk about what the breadth of it could be, what would still lie outside of a single auditing entity, and then how that report back. And I'm sure if that entity were to find something, the MCOs would have to go back and validate in some way before major consequences are implemented. But Virginia?
So, like the comment you made earlier, so this number seven is akin to trying to eat an elephant, and maybe the best way to start this would be one bite, and that maybe that first bite is to perhaps pick a service type like MHR and see how we might be able to make it work at that level, and then depending on the outcome, consider, then we could evolve it to other service types down the line if that seems reasonable.
That's true. So I would ask Kathy to maybe take that back when you reconvene with your MCOs and pitch this and see if they can make it a little smaller and start in that way. It might make the difference than from the outcome a year ago.
Okay, I got it.
Okay, I have a comment, or I'm not even sure if it's a question, because Kathy raised this. You raised this issue about some of the MCOs having, requirements from their parent companies. And I think we've discussed a lot about this at one point in the MHR work group. And so, when we're looking at standardization of audits as an example here, I know it's difficult. I mean, this is one of the issues that we are kind of that providers have to deal with, is that across the companies, there's a different, sometimes even definition of what, constitutes quality of care, or what constitutes, following a certain standard of care. And I think that from the provider standpoint, what we've had to deal with in those audits is we have people from all over the country interpreting the Medicaid standards from the manual in their own way and applying that to what we're doing here with a recipient in Louisiana, in this program. And I don't, it's like, how do we deal with that? So again, getting back to the whole purpose of this committee is, if we just have one MCO and their parent company to deal with, then that's one issue. But when you have five, and now six if you include Magellan, six different quality standards for a parent company somewhere else in this country, looking at what we're doing with a recipient in Louisiana following the Medicaid regulations in Louisiana from the manual that we go by, I mean, it's just unfair in a lot of ways. And I don't know, based on having all of these parent companies and these audits, which in several companies, they have local auditors doing these audits, and they have audits from contractors of their own in different states that really have no idea what we do here. And so how do we deal with this? I mean, I don't have any ideas.
And so let me say, I think from the quality monitoring side, if there could be a single entity that would address that, Virginia, please don't kill me for keep putting you on the spot. From a program integrity perspective, is it allowable to kind of mandate whoever they're contracting with, if that's allowed, to be from a certain location, to be internal or external, to be Louisiana? I mean, have you seen that?
They are required in their SIUs to have their investigators within the state, a certain number of them based on what their patient population is. But the record review, the clinical review of records, particularly when you have a national organization, they may have people in one location that do clinical record review for a particular provider type. If you think about it, physicians also are evaluated in much the same way. The clinical reviewer for physician's records might be located in Washington State or in Florida or in Texas.
Yeah. And so with that, let me ask, I've asked periodically in all of these meetings, do we have any perspective that wants to speak up outside of MHR? Because I've asked about kind of how this plays out with hospitals that see both sides. If physicians are a good example. Any voice on the line that also experiences this from the primary care side? I don't know if LHA.
I'm with the medical society. Oh. I can ask and get back to y'all.
Yeah, I would be interested to see kind of if their complaints around auditing and out-of-state auditors and the volume of audits. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And so, Karen, I want to, on this same point, I want to say this. Certainly, any provider that I think it can certainly be said with a great deal of accuracy that any provider that doesn't understand why the standards are in the published LDH quality review audit tool or there hasn't read the provider manual. But back to Rob's point, in dealing with these distant entities that are conducting these audits, I know on more than one occasion where a provider has received a recoupment, let's just say, of $170,000. And over the course of time, that recoupment was settled for $4,000. And in most of those cases, or at least in the three cases that I personally know about, the reduction was a function of going through each of those audit findings, looking at the standard in the audit tool versus what was in the provider manual, and seeing many times that there was a clear disconnect or a clear, I'm going to use disconnect, it's probably a better word for it, but there was a clear disconnect between how the provider was interpreting those standards and how to meet those standards operationally within their agency, and how the auditor in North Carolina understood what that policy in the manual was trying to convey, and that seems to have been the most successful way that at least those three providers were able to whittle down this gargantuan recoupment to something that basically ended up being repayment of some claims that were submitted as duplicate claims and paid both times, at least in two of those three cases. So I think this kind of gets back to two issues. It gets back to training of the people who are doing the reviews on what the standards intended, and also, and that needs to be defined, I think, to a great degree, on what the department indicates that those standards in the provider manual are intended to communicate, and how those are to be general guidelines as to how those are to be implemented operationally. So I think that's a big part of this, and it's part of what's frustrating to us as providers when we get the audit results outside of that category of clear fraud, waste, and abuse. Is a lack of agreement on how those standards actually reflect how those audit standards, those audit items, actually reflect the intent of the policies in the provider manual. That's a huge area.
A basic lack of understanding of the program by the auditors.
Absolutely.
And so I'm wondering on how we can address that through training, given the volume. And I'm wondering from the MCOs how they communicate with their, if they're contracted or their national auditors, about the program, what that lines of communication. And I'm not sure if we've got any MCOs that want to talk about that and how they've taken the step to train their national people on kind of the local program, or any suggestions?
And I think that's where you run into a disconnect too, between what we may find in the audit processes for physicians because those procedure codes are pretty traditional. They're pretty traditional CPT codes. But at least in the area, and it may be that way to a great extent with behavioral health hospitals in the state of Louisiana, those are pretty much billed on traditional CPT codes through Medicaid. But this home and community-based program is a hybrid. It's unique to Louisiana. And I think the understanding of what procedure codes for health and for home and community-based services, how those procedure codes interpret to the standards in the manual and how that cross-references to the process standards that are in the audit tools is absolutely a foreign language to the people who are conducting audits on these home and community-based programs versus these more traditional programs that are still, for in many respects, DRG-driven and operating off of very traditional and very standardized CPT-type codes.
So this is Dr. Mueller, and I do want to respond to the question I was allowed to respond to or asked to respond to. But I would like to also respond to John's point, but I'll go first. And I think that we've talked about this in some of the general MHR meetings, but that the MCOs in Louisiana, the conducting the everyday Louisiana MCO business, there is a firewall between us and the SIU, the Special Investigation Unit. And there is not to be communication between the two of us. We are a very separate entity, which I understand can sometimes lead to a feeling that the corporate, if you will, SIU individuals are not necessarily Louisiana-based and they may not understand Louisiana-specific programs. There is at least a few individuals within the Louisiana-based line of business who do have a conduit of communication with the SIU unit. And there are occasions when SIU will reach out to us at the Louisiana level to discuss certain things. So it's not a complete lack of communication, but there is a firewall and there is a distinct limit of information that gets exchanged. So I can't emphasize enough how that is a given within the MCOs. And it's not unique just to AmeriHealth. I think that's among all the MCOs, that there's firewall between the line of business and the SIU investigation unit. The MHR program in Louisiana, at least as I know, there are other lines of business within AmeriHealth who have very similar programs in other states. So it's not a distinctly unique entity in Louisiana. And I think that may help, know that if there is an SIU investigation, they are not totally uninformed about this program because it does exist in other lines of business in other states. How Louisiana and their manual, the LDH, behavior health, I never get the right name, clinical service manual dictates the program may be somewhat different, but the program does exist. A community-based CPST, PSR program exists in other states. So I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Dr. Mueller, thank you for bringing those points up. And I guess my question is, what the question for providers here, and I think we discussed this a little earlier in the meeting, is what triggers an SIU audit? You know, I mean, is it the same for every company? Or is that different? Because if it's different, this is what the providers are dealing with. we don't know why we're getting these SIU audits sometimes. And then, as you say, then we question, you know, the local company as to what's going on when we have just recently gotten a process audit that we scored a 98% on, and then all of a sudden, another part of your company, not necessarily your company, a company, you know, starts conducting an SIU audit. So, and we have no idea why. And I think if the reasons are different for every company, and we can't ask you why or our provider, you know, liaison why, because they don't know. And so this is the whole point, is that if the standards are different for what triggers an SIU audit for every company, this issue, you know, becomes just, you know, impossible for providers to deal with.
And so, Dr. Muller, I'm not sure that you can answer on behalf of the five MCOs. I'm wondering if Virginia has a more kind of global response to that.
Well, okay, my first comment is an SIU is an investigative unit. So you have to look at it through that lens. You're not going to know often why they are looking at you. You may often not even know initially that they are looking at you.
So it could be random. It could be data analytics. It could be something else. An SIU audit
is generally not going to be purely random. It's going to be, there's going to be something that's going to generate it. It's going to be a complaint, but that complaint, as with the SIRS unit, can come from any number of different sources, or it could be data analytics. An example of the data analytics is they run data analytics and they see impossible days. Either a recipient is receiving more than 24 hours of service, or an individual provider is providing more than 24 hours of service. We know that can happen, and that's likely to trigger an SIU audit. But then there are other types of data analytics that may also trigger an SIU audit. There are certain red flags that are indicators of fraud. And you're not going to know what those are. That's not something that that the SIUs or the Program Integrity Unit here at LDH or the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit is going to share, because if it's widely known that these are the things that make us take a closer look, then behaviors will change accordingly. And just because the behavior changes in what's in the record keeping or what's in the billing pattern does not mean that the provider's behavior that may be fraudulent has changed.
Yeah, I think if I may ask something right here, we have identified the problem. The problem is so vast, huge, cumbersome that nobody knows how it fits us. Nobody here, except the providers community, which is the MHR. The physicians or the hospital may have their own personal problem or whatever they go through. So I think what we should concentrate on at this point is to see how we can resolve it. Because what the president is saying, John, or the vice president, Rob, we talk about these things all the time. And it is very, very hard for us to put two and two together. And we should be looking at that and see how we can solve it. Because this standardization will help us. And not only that, getting just maybe a national or a personal kind of audit that we can maybe recruit or have from the MCO, that can also help us. Everything that they are saying, there's a huge disconnect. We don't know what we are doing. Today we will hear, we'll get another audit from one MCO. Tomorrow you see another audit. So it is a five times problem that this problem has been identified. So we need to really look at it right now and see how we can really break it and solve it for us, because it's a huge problem and that is causing a lot of, how can you sustain your company? How can you move on from one place to another place? or one spot to another spot. That's what we are thinking every day today. So I want us to really look at it on that way and see how we can, how you guys can help us. Everybody, anybody, help us deal with this issue. The problem has been identified.
I agree. I think that's why we're here. I think this was a good step, having some recommendations, good or bad, realistic or not realistic. I think that's everyone's unified goal. So, Rob, John, I don't want to, I want to make sure we spend a little bit of time on number six. And I know my expert in the room, Virginia, has a time cap for this afternoon. So we've kind of touched on this before, the clearly written definitions of fraud, waste, and abuse. And so, John, I'm wondering if you could give us a little introduction about your thought process behind that one, and then we'll start the discussion.
Well, I think what we're seeing, I think it really comes back to this. And I'm going to invite my other colleagues on the line to chip in here. I think this question is related to the fact that A, we're getting so many audits. I mean, 10, 15 audits a year, and it's expensive for us to have to put all of that information together and ship it all, so that the companies can look at it. And then the results come back and we're seeing these huge recoupments. But there's no indication that fraud, waste, or abuse actually occurred in these audits. It's that the treatment plan that you sent in, that you copied off of your EHR, doesn't have the clinician's signature at the bottom. We talk about this a lot. Well, those were electronic signatures, and many of the EHRs, many of the EHRs we're using, when they print, don't print the signatures. I know that was the case with the agency that we were at. So part of the expense here is if I'm shipping off 30 records, and the same thing is true of the progress notes, and I've got 250 progress notes in one record, then do I just send it without the electronic signatures, or do I have somebody sit down and write the signatures on every one of those progress notes that we send in so we don't get an audit finding back saying the note was not signed? And there are liabilities associated with doing that. So that's an issue. But I think the point, so those things, those are the kinds of things that we're seeing. We talk to the investigator, we say these things, And one of the questions many of us ask is, well, am I being investigated for fraud, waste, and abuse? No, this is an investigative audit, or this is a compliance audit. These are the findings. And we found that 15% of your cases didn't meet qualification X. So we conclude by statistical analysis that applies, since that's a random selection, that it applies to 15% of all of your cases, so please send us a check for $179,000. They're not pointing so much to fraud, waste, and abuse, so I think part of our question is, if it's not fraud, waste, and abuse, why are we being hit with these huge recoupments versus a corrective action claim? And I think that's what it really comes down to. So we're trying to understand this by saying, well, what does constitute fraud, waste, and abuse? So we can have a better understanding of whether the audit findings do or do not point to fraud, waste, and abuse. And if not, why are we being hit with these large recoupments and not a corrective action plan? I hope that helps, and I invite my colleagues to jump in.
So, Virginia, any initial thoughts on this?
Okay, the first thing is the definition of fraud, waste, and abuse is it's been elusive nationwide. Fraud is fairly well defined in the criminal statutes, and the major element in fraud is intent. So it's, you knew it was wrong and you did it anyway. But there are often instances where intent is very, very difficult to prove, and that's when things tend to get lumped into the waste and abuse category, when the investigators know that even though they may suspect there's intent there, it, you know, proving someone's state of mind is a very, very difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. But definitely, you know, what really defines things, I may have a very different definition than someone else would of where those lines are drawn.
So Virginia, I thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So I'm hearing what you say is that there are multiple points of focus that could result in these, in the need for an audit, and that includes consumer complaints, so forth and so on. So as you're looking at that, how is a definition made as to whether the audit will be a quality review audit or an investigative audit?
I can't really answer that. I mean, I think that the determination of whether something is an investigative audit or a quality review audit is more a matter of what the origin of the audit is.
Origin of the complaint, origin of the audit, origin of the requirement. For example, our 358, I think there's a certain number that are required to be reviewed at, you know, in a sample kind of thing. MCOs, any thought? Or Kathy? Any comments?
This is Lisa from NAMI New Orleans.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. So in our experience, we receive a request for records that says this is just a standard routine audit. And then a great length of time passes, and then we're notified by an SIU audit that we owe back a great deal of money. And in our case, it's usually based on the quality of the progress note. So that kind of speaks to what John was talking about before. There's no real specific indication of fraud or abuse. We have been told by one MCO that a progress note that's not written properly and their determination is considered waste, but the initial audit was listed as this is just a standard audit. The other thing that I brought to the attention of the group a couple of days ago is that the provider is usually given 10 or 15 days to respond at whatever point. You have 10 to 15 days to give us these records. You have 30 days to pay us back. You have X number of days to appeal. But when we submit these documents to the MCOs, large amounts of time passes before we're notified of a result. And in one of the cases, it was over 587 days later. And so again, it's just an element of fairness that we're given only 10 or 15 days. And then the MCO, there does not appear to be any set timeline for them to respond. And then my last point is that we recently received a contract revision from one of the MCOs that just says these changes have been made to your contract. And the language says that the MCO has the right to audit 10 years from the final date of the contract period. And so I think that basically gives them or puts us in a position where we have to be responsible for maintaining records basically indefinitely, because if it's 10 years from the final date of the contract period, that doesn't seem like that has an end.
So I kind of looked at Virginia. I'm wondering about kind of statute of limitations on audits, and does it ever end? Once fraud, always fraud. They had the right to go in forever.
With fraud, there's actually some different ways that it can be looked at. I mean, if it's an ongoing act, you can go back to the very beginning of the ongoing act. So if let's say a business is just a fraudulent business completely, and you discover it 15 years into the operation, you can still go back to the very beginning of the operation. That's just a general thing. There are certain, you know, limitations, prescriptive periods on different statutes, and In Louisiana, the general prescriptive period on fraud is 4 years. Mm-hmm. But as I said, if you've got that connection to the earlier services, then or the earlier claims, then it can go back beyond that period. And then there are federal requirements. The federal statutes are different.
Mm-hmm.
Five, six, 7 years.
Yeah.
The 10 years, I think, may pertain to false claims. Those are civil actions, and yeah, I think 10 years is a pretty standard amount for a False Claims Act, either under state or federal legislation. But I'm not familiar with how that would impact the MCOs and their relationships with the providers.
So these are. Go ahead.
This is Kendra from LHCC. I just might can help. But I believe the 10-year language is new in our emergency contract from LDH requiring us to have 10 years.
And that's probably because of false claims.
Mm-hmm. So basically the closure, to answer the original provider Lisa's kind of concern about timelines, is that a lot of these timelines are due to different state and federal laws and regulations. And there's an allowance and sometimes a requirement to do that look back or that audit up until these timelines. And so while the closure of a case from a provider perspective would like that to happen much earlier and kind of put it to bed and move on, because a lot changes in 10 years legally, there is a responsibility for these amounts of time. So John, just for some awareness of time, there are several things on your list that we have addressed. Let me ask the group, because we have your recommendations in writing and we've discussed most of them. Are there other audit-related recommendations that people can think of? And again, we're resolution-focused. So not this is what happened to me, this is my complaint, but here's an idea about how we can streamline audits or improve the communication and still ensure compliance. I want to make sure we have time to put other ideas on the table.
So while people are kind of thinking, one of the things that I have thought of as we've gone through this discussion, it's just a whole discussion around audit tools. I've learned a lot about what's being used. I've learned a lot to ask additional questions. And again, we approach this from the point of view of training on the audit tools and how those audit tools could be used as a resource and not a headache. In our agencies would be valuable. But I think to get to that, we have to see the audit tools. And what's concerning me a little bit at this point is that there obviously is not a single audit tool that's been provided to the MCOs by the department. There is an audit tool that the department has public that's being used by the MCOs to develop their own tools. So we have five MCOs developing their own tools, and then within those MCOs, there are two categories, quality reviews and investigative audits. So that subdivides it even more. So potentially we have 10 audit tools. So I'm just wondering, how do we get to the training piece if what we're talking about is multiple tools being used by five MCOs that potentially have developed that audit tool based upon divergent understanding of what the program standards require? That's my question at this point. If we're going to use this somehow as an audit tool, as an educational tool.
So, and I think one kind of overarching comment I feel the need to make is that other than the quality monitoring tool 358 that we will walk everyone, the MHR group through at one of the stakeholder meetings after the first of the year, there's this need, providers really want a tool, but there is no requirement to have a tool. And I think as Virginia touched on, especially from the SIU perspective, when fraud is identified, every case of fraud is so unique. You know, if the tool mandates looking at progress notes, but the audit has nothing to do with progress notes, then the tool's irrelevant, kind of just as a really bad example. That fraud's not standardized, so it's hard to have a pre-made response kind of ready or investigative toolkit ready. I think that the easiest kind of area to educate is on those quality monitoring tools, because those standards of the program are a little more set. And so I seem to remember when we talked about audits in MHR, some of the MCOs may have offered or talked about that they do some training or one-off trainings in relation to their kind of quality audits. Again, SIU audits are specific to the situation at hand, is what I understand. So there might not be a tool at play, but from the MCOs, outside of a 358 report training, I'm wondering, Kathy, if there really is a standard audit tool that that can be trained on with each of the MCOs. And so maybe that's a follow-up
item. Karen, I can follow up. But I mean, the tool that is used from the 358, is that the word? The one?
Yeah,
that one is, my understanding, that is standard. That is being used as a standard tool across the MCOs. Maybe some of the MCOs can respond to that. But in terms of the other, as you said, I'm not sure there are tools that are developed for individual audits. And again, hopefully maybe some of the MCOs can respond. If not, I can follow up with them.
I do want to respond to the 358 audit tool. As Karen has said multiple times, you know, it's available online. The five MCOs have joined together to develop training on that particular quality monitoring tool of behavioral health providers. They have a PowerPoint developed. The problem is now the PowerPoint has to go through each MCO legal department. And so this was the request to, maybe it hasn't been put in writing yet, but Kathy and Karen, if somehow this can be I don't know how to phrase it, but if it can come from OBH or LDH and you all approve the PowerPoint that the five MCOs have pulled together, then it may not have to go through each MCO's legal department. That's the holdup with that training that the MCOs are ready to offer.
And so, Dr. Muller, I will follow up on that and see, maybe we can, Kathy and I can have a conversation offline on how we can kind of jumpstart that, which would be kind of a similar, you know, training that I offered on 358, but I didn't realize there was kind of a joint one already created and working through the process, so that's even better. So I'll commit to seeing what OBH can do to own that might help speed it up.
Thank you.
We'll circle back on that.
And Karen, I think what's also important, and I love what Dr. Mueller just said, I think what's important that really takes all these threads and ties them together as much as possible is that the department is looking at that tool. This goes back to the training issue and inter-rater reliability. Does the implementation of that tool, when it comes out, by the MCOs meet the department's expectations about what those standards are meant to convey? So that's important. Inter-rater reliability within the raters, within the MCOs, and across the MCOs is critically important. And then extending that kind of inter-rater reliability to the quality maintenance people within provider agencies is also important, because what this standardization really points to for us beyond just standardization and knowing how to use that tool as a quality enhancement tool within our agency and network development broadly. It's how we, the providers, can use that information to protect ourselves. That's really, really important.
I agree, John, and I'll look at that. I'll look into this and get it unstuck where it, if it is stuck. So
can I add one more thing to that recommendation, which is, you know, we discussed earlier in this meeting, is what are the consequences of infractions or problems that are discovered by using this specific clinical audit tool. In other words, you know, what specifically, I think that, and I would hope that the MCOs could agree, well, an example of the fact that you didn't write a note, you don't have a note for a charge, let's just say that was discovered in a clinical audit. Then of course, you know, we understand the consequence for that is that would probably be bumped up to your SIU, audit and potentially, have recoupment or whatever being done. And I think that's part of the issue is that we don't know. So can we really look at and maybe even include as part of this training is, you know, what happens when we implement this tool when in an audit? What are the consequences for, certain things that we find in the audit? How long does it take us to even get the results of the audit? In some situations, we don't even get the results of these process clinical audits for 6 months or a year. There's no standardization. And also, you know, again, what's going to happen when we do get the results? I've been asked by a company to do a plan of action for some things they found in an audit, which we passed the audit, but they wanted a plan of action on, correction on a few things that they had concerns about. And I said, okay, fine. What are those things? They said, we can't really tell you what those things are. It's in this area. They would not specifically give me the results of the audit before they said the plan of correction is due in 30 days. So we just had to make something up. And it just, those are some examples that there's no timelines. There needs to be more standardization of, okay, how audits are conducted, what the standards are that they're looking at, how long it takes for them to get back to you about the results, and what do the results, the consequences of the results.
So I understand, and I've heard several people say it, and I think, Rob, you started out saying about the range of consequences and how important that is to you to kind of have an awareness of and some consistency. I'll go ahead and say I think one of the concerns is, if you standardize the consequence, it really limits the response. For example, you don't sign one progress note versus you've never signed a progress note, so signing of a note doesn't sound like it should be a big deal, but if you've never signed one, then maybe it's a bigger deal. Or looking at progress notes and they're all signed, but they're every single one of them's cut and pasted. That kind of concern about too much standardization will cause more or less kind of issues around it. But I do hear what you're saying, and you're right. There should be some sort of idea about this is egregious versus not. And with that comes a certain set of expectations that, of course, there would always be exceptions to, but you need some sort of expectation. So, John, let me get back to your list of nine. Are there any others that you want to specifically – oh, actually, I had one that I wanted to specifically talk about, and this is idea with number four and outcomes. I'm wondering if – and this – I don't want to spend too much time because I think it might be a good conversation for the MHR stakeholder group, but the proposal from your group of certain outcome measures – I think would be interesting for MHR specifically. And I'm not saying in lieu of these process measures, because as I've mentioned before, until we see a higher level of compliance from the provider type as a whole, not these 12 providers that are clearly active participants, but the data reflects that as a whole, there still needs to be some process monitoring. But I'm curious, as we move towards more outcome-driven decisions, what outcome measures you guys would propose for MHR specifically? And I don't think it's appropriate to talk about here, because your outcome measures are likely to be different than a physician's or a residential treatment provider or a substance use provider, which is the behavioral unit as a whole. But I'm wondering if you could – maybe you and I could just talk offline and make an MHR stakeholder meeting about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a whole lot. Absolutely. There's a whole lot I could say about that. I think it'd be better to do it offline. Yep. Okay.
So anything else that you want to talk about specifically? And then I'm going to open it up to the group again to talk audits, questions, complaints, concerns, recommendation, and then we'll open it up to the public, and then we'll call it a Friday. So, John, anything else on this one pager?
I'm good with opening up to the group. But at this point, I really want to hear from the group. Yes.
Yeah. So group. Anything's on the table around audits?
Okay. This is Donnie. I've kept pretty quiet this call. I've just been listening, and there's a couple things that I would love to just kind of recap on. That we talked about. And I'd also like to just sort of bring up, you know, one of the first comments I made on our first call. And that was how, you know, how the program now compares to what the program has been over past years or over past versions of the program. And obviously auditing, I think, is a big part of that. And, you know, as a provider who's been around for a long time, and I know there's several other providers on this call who've also been around a long time, I think why audits are such a big sticking point for us with this discussion is that we've seen a drastic change in our audit results. Not so much the type of audits we're getting necessarily. You know, obviously we're getting different types of audits now because we're getting audits through an MCOSIU. But we've had other types of, many of us, I would imagine, have had other types of investigative audits in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, like Rob said earlier, you know, obviously, if an audit reveals a charge and you can't find the note is missing, then, yeah, you know, a recoupment is in order. And I think most providers, that has always been the gold standard of, hey, you know, if there's no note, look, maybe it's not fraud. Maybe you just lost the note, but you're recouping the money. That's it. You know, you don't get to get paid if you don't have your documentation for it. Okay. And we've all had seen things like that, but again, like others have said, that's not the kind of recoupments we're seeing these days. These days we're seeing a recoupment for, oh, you know, this one form that you submitted, well, this checkbox wasn't checked off on it. So now we want to recoup all of your claims for that particular client over this date range, which, I don't know, may have been a whole year or something. So not only is it as, and I'll use this word because I like how it gets used sometimes, is not only does that just sound egregious to me, I imagine it sounds extremely egregious to others. Now, what makes it even worse, though, is when you go back and you look over the records that you submitted, and in fact, that box was checked off the whole time. And you're like, okay, auditor, you just said that I was missing something that I actually had. So, you know, getting back into workload with all this stuff is that, you know, we're not only going through these multiple audits, but then we're also having to go back over those same audits and then fight over them, you know, over things like a checkbox or, well, you know, we couldn't find the signature and there was a signature, you know, or I mean, again, it's this dot your I, cross your T, silly nitpicking stuff that has nothing to do with fraud. And I don't think there's a provider on this call or many providers out there who would just say, yeah, I deserve to get paid for fraud. Now, I know there are some, but, you know, to me, that's a different thing. Again, obviously, you know, if you forgot to check off a box, in my opinion, that does not constitute fraud. You know, fraud is when you purposely go out and bill for something you did not do or that the client did not need. You know, and again, I'm preaching to the choir here. You know, I firmly believe that, you know, and I feel like that has been the big change. You know, I feel like we used to be able to trust who was auditing us. And we still do trust a lot of the people who audit us. You know, I think in a lot of ways, the local audits that take place, and by local, I mean the people from the MCOs locally, when they audit us, I feel like we have a collaborative experience in most cases. You know, I feel like we receive good feedback in those cases and we get fair results in those cases. But, you know, we've talked about the SIU thing several times because I think those are the cases that really stand out to us and that there's this person from some other place who's a coder or this or whoever who's out of state and they come back with all these just very strange results, you know, that we certainly did not anticipate or could have anticipated.
Donnie, let's focus on recommendations and potential resolutions. So given your experiences, do you have additional recommendations other than the 9 that would help confront the situations you've just described?
Well, you know, the challenging part with recommendations is that I feel like we made a bunch of recommendations today, but there were also reasons for why those recommendations may not work, such as, well, each company has its own requirements. You know, now, yeah, could there be some recommendations that say, hey, look, you know, they can still subject us to all these audits, but if you're going to recoup, it better be for fraud. You know, it better be because something was literally missing, you know, because, and to be honest, that's my biggest recommendation that I think should exist. I don't think there's a legislator or an individual or anybody out there who would say, yeah, you need to recoup for fraud, you know, but when it gets into this, you know, this ominous definition of waste that seems to be out there that everybody's that the recoupments are mostly falling under, you know, it's I feel like it's just this free for all and let's recoup for, you know, the missing checkbox. And, you know, I think if we got into more specific definitions of what can be recouped for, and again, you know, maybe there is a more clear definition of fraud or abuse that already exists. You know, maybe if we centered around those definitions of, yeah, obviously, you know, this person's documentation is not there, it's gone. Or the documentation clearly says they're doing something that was not CPST or behavioral health or whatever you want to call it. You know, to me, you know, if I had to make a generalized recommendation that may actually apply to everybody, it would be, let's keep it simple. You know, let's get very specific about, look, you know, there's, you know, 1,000 process standards. So what are you going to do? Recoup every time, you know, all the claims if they missed one? You know, it gets into these, you know, how do you handle, you know, well, we would like a provider to improve. versus a provider is committing fraud, you know, it's a big difference, you know, and I feel like ultimately what we want, what everybody wants, is to see that the money, the taxpayers, that taxpayers are paying is actually getting spent on something that's going to help people who need the help, you know, and I think if providers are doing their best to do that and they're not maliciously doing things that deviate from that, obviously, or doing anything malicious, I mean, to me, that's the biggest differentiation I can make. And to make recommendations is challenging, of course, because like you said, you know, you run into other roadblocks and, you know, trying to standardize it across all five plans may be a challenge, you know, that's the other thing. And, you know, I know that's why we had this work group, was because, hey, we went from one plan to five plans and then this all happened. And then we also heard other reasons why, well, now we're getting pressure from the legislative auditor to do more audits, you know, so maybe that's part of why things have changed.
Yeah, but let me just be clear that I think the pressure is because the data is showing more fraud, and it may mm-hmm. not be for you specific providers on this call, but the data is showing there is a certain provider type that is committing more fraud. The volume of complaints, I believe the AG said almost 60-something percent of their complaints are specific to MHR providers from other MHR providers. So I just want to be clear that it's not coming out of nowhere, and there is a basis for some of this. And I think maybe your perspective is from your provider agencies and the good providers you're surrounding yourself with. That is not the perspective of providers as a whole. So just want to put that out there that it's happening, and that's why people are taking it seriously. And audits are going to happen. And I disagree that we didn't have a couple of good things come out of this conversation. And you know, and I want to point out that five providers are what thousands of other providers, I mean, five MCOs are what thousands of other provider types are also dealing with. So, this wasn't done to MHR providers. It's all providers have five managed care companies, and all the data is being looked at, and this is where we're seeing issues.
Well, let me just say that I'm glad you brought up the AG, because the AG investigates fraud and abuse, and that's what we all agree with. Recoup for fraud, shut them down. Shut down providers who they identify fraud and abuse with. But that's not what the recoupments are taking place for. I don't believe, anyway. I'm looking at right now, I have on my computer screen, in August 2017, Louisiana Focus Program Integrity Review, final report, and in 2016, there was almost no overpayments recovered due to fraud and abuse. You know, there was like less than 1% of all of the audits that were conducted, of all the investigations that were conducted, actually got referred to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. And look, I don't know what happened since then, because I don't have a more updated one. But I wouldn't be surprised if the updated one looks similar, where it's literally less than 1% that are actually getting picked up by the Fraud Control Unit. And look, I'm not trying to say the whole program is innocent. That's not my intent. I'm just saying that we need to do recoupments for things that deserve recoupments. You know, I don't think we should be, you know, slamming providers on things that weren't even the intent behind, like, the complaints that you're talking about. You know, if somebody receives a fraud complaint, I'm not even, you know, look, yes, I will complain and say, yes, audits are burdensome. They're a real pain. Yes, they are. Nobody can say that they aren't. I think it'd be ridiculous if you said you enjoyed audits. But what really rubs the salt in the wound and just makes you want to just scream is when you get your audit results and either the results are inaccurate, but they want money back because they're inaccurate, or the things that they're specifying that they want to recoup for aren't even legitimate things to recoup money for. And by legitimate, I mean, if you have a legal team review that or the department review it, they won't agree with those specific items to recoup for. So, I know that may not be the standard across the board, but I know other providers on this call are part of this work group for that very reason. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. I just want to add, Karen, I think your point, and we agree with everything that you said about actual fraud being committed in the program. And again, I don't think that's what we're discussing. And this is kind of what I had been bringing up earlier is, in a sense, what's an appropriate consequence for a clinical audit? But I think maybe if we could deal with it in a different way, is that when we do respond, Donnie, you have examples of this. Another provider had an example who they were reviewing all their personnel files, and every single person had CPR and first aid, but one of their staff members did not have first aid. They just had CPR. And they said, fine, everything that staff member has done for the last, 3 months, we're recouping money for. When 98% of your personnel files met the standard, but this one had CPR, but not first aid. And then we're asking, how is that really impacting, the work that has been done by this particular staff member? Is that negating everything that they've done and now we need to pay you money back? So those are just examples that, in a sense, we're asking for a ruling on this by OBH to say, is that reasonable that you're requesting money back for something like this, for a box not being checked on a form? Is that reasonable?
So I understand, Rob, and I was just about to summarize after Donnie and say that it sounds like his point was similar to yours, which was about needing the clearer consequences for certain things. But Ernest wants to say something before, because he's about to leave, so let's give him a chance.
Yeah, thank you very much, Karen. I really love the way you're handling it. You see, I don't think there's any reasonable or seasoned licensed person that want to put the license on the line just because of unreasonable stuff. I don't think there is anyone. It's all about the integrity of what you do qualitatively or even quantitatively. It's not, I cannot put my license or jeopardize my own self for this. But we know that there are a lot of disgruntled people out there. So, but this, we're talking about this standardization of audit, how we can use it to advance our growth in MHR or whatever we do. So that is the main point. So I'm going to put another recommendation. One in a year, please. One audit a year, that's it. Not 20, not 30, just one. That's just in addition to whatever we have there. Mm-hmm. So that's just all I want to say. So thank you for going back to New Orleans.
Thank you. You be careful.
Thank
have
you
a
so
great
much.
Weekend.
Thank you.
Let me open it up to anyone else who has some general comments from the work group. All right. Any public non-work group members that want to say anything?
Karen, this is John. I'd just like to make a couple here that I think does fit within the recommendation that we've made here. And I think this discussion in the last few minutes takes us back to that intersection between process and outcome measures. And so I think, all right, process measures, fine. We've got to look at those, just like we have to look at the audits. But back to a couple of the examples that have been made, for example, the one chart that didn't have the box check that the staff member received CPR, they only received first aid, or maybe it was vice versa. I think in cases like that, if there's gross noncompliance, if there is fraud, waste, and abuse, those are cut and dried cases. Those agencies should be dealt with in clear and uncertain terms. I think outside of that, then we get to the question of what should drive this ship down the road of a corrective action plan versus recoupment. And I think that's where the outcome issue comes into some subjective decision making in this respect. Okay, the box didn't get checked. We're therefore going to request, we're going to recoup everything that that provider provided to all of those clients. But otherwise, the record seems to show that the client did get services, that services were provided. And outside of the box not being checked, they were provided in good faith. So there's a part of this that's missing, I think, in the decision to go with corrective action plan versus recoupment. And I wonder how much this is occurring in the investigative audit. Did somebody call the client and say, what do you think about the services that you got from that agency? And if the client says, I'm delighted with the service, I'm getting better, these things have improved, then maybe that helps to drive the ship in terms of whether the recommendation is going to be made for a corrective action plan versus recoupment. I just wanted to offer that.
That's interesting. I think that's something we should talk about when we talk about outcome-driven and kind of how the consumer experience plays into it. I can just off the top of my head think lots of pros and cons with that. But and we do something similar on a larger scale. But that would be interesting to talk about how it can be incorporated as one of your outcome measures. And y'all on the phone should know that we're starting to lose people in the room left and right. So people are starting to exit for their weekend. So let me do kind of a last call for questions and comments from anyone about anything. All right, Jackson, our next meeting.
I believe it is
22nd of November.
Yeah, 3 weeks from today.
Okay.
And the topic of that is going to be clinical concerns with integrated care through the MCOs.
Okay, so those, just a refresher, guys, we had kind of a series of issues on the table around prior authorizations and medical necessity determinations and kind of consistency across that, which we just kind of loosely grouped under kind of clinical concerns versus these audit, administrative, billing, and payment kind of concerns. So. All right, guys. Well, with that, thank you for your attendance and participation on a Friday afternoon. We appreciate it. Same deal next time, in-person option and the Zoom line. And we will talk to everyone then. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Karen. Bye-bye.